Welcome to The Hidden Edge, the go-to podcast on mental fitness for business leaders and their teams, by me, Jodie Rogers, peak performance consultant to world-leading organisations. My next guest is Matthew McCarthy, CEO of Ben & Jerry's. And in this conversation, we dug into so many topics, from, of course, the importance of mental fitness in 2020, but also social injustice and why it's important to take a stand, but also be prepared for the consequences of that. We dig into vulnerability and how that is a strength, not a weakness, and what that looks like right now. We covered so much. The conversation actually went on for 90 minutes. We both got really into it. We have edited it down for the purposes of this podcast, but I encourage you to put the kettle on, brew yourself a nice cup of coffee or cup of tea or whatever you like, and sit back and enjoy. Thank you so much for giving your time, because I know that you are extremely busy.
First of all, thanks for reaching out to me. There isn't a moment of the day that doesn't go by that mental and emotional well-being isn't part of what I'm thinking about or what we're talking about, maybe not every minute, but certainly every day, and every message I've got with my team is absolutely centered on this. Absolutely.
Yeah. And has that always been the case for you, or has that been come to the fore because of 2020?
Well, a couple things. I've always, sometimes to the detriment of my progress in business, I have always connected to the humanity side of the stuff we do every day. That's helped me as a marketer, from an insights perspective, and kind of connecting emotionally with the people that we serve. But within the business, it actually may have stunted my career in the early days, because, and I'm not saying I'm like Mr. Expert on mental and emotional wellness. I was wired a certain way, and that didn't always fit. I like to tell people that in organizations, decisiveness often masquerades as intelligence. This is true, particularly in kind of male-dominated environments. Even when I've had, been working with female leaders who have adopted kind of that old-fashioned white male power structure, tough decisions and decisions, when the reality is it's much, much harder to actually talk about the humanity of what you're doing. And I find that people steel themselves for, it's a tough decision, and tough decisions are needed, almost as if your decision is validated if some people suffered, like they lost their job, they got fired, whatever else, they got screwed on the bonus, whatever it might be. Somehow that's seen as kind of resilience and toughness. And that's bullshit. It's absolute bullshit. And I think it's a cop-out. Just because you have the courage to fire a lot of people. I mean, I can fire a lot of people. I've done plenty of times. That is not resilience. That is not tough. It may be needed, but don't fucking tell me that you're a tough leader because you can hide your emotions and fire people. Or to steel yourself to close a plant and put 200 people out of work. That may be necessary for the business. I'm not saying the two coexist. Necessary. If we don't do this, we are out of business. Do it. Okay, fine. That doesn't mean that we don't talk about how these people are going to have to go home, and you just shattered that town. You just shattered those people's lives. Both are true. And interestingly, humans, we somehow, I'm not going to start talking too much now, but we move towards carrots and we move away from sticks. And sometimes we are aware of the stick, and sometimes we only see its shadow. We will still move because we think there's a stick coming. And then people pass that off as, courage. Bullshit. It's a really broken narrative that comes, like, that I believe is, I can't speak for other people's lived experiences, but I can speak for a white male of privilege lived experience. And so, there's a lot of bullshit there. And I think you can't have a conversation about new power. you know, which is now kind of like that. When did that start to take off? You know, several years ago, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, you know, the New Power book and the guys from Harvard and all that stuff. You can't have a New Power conversation and not talk about what you're talking about. And for me, the business case is crystal clear. The human and the business case flows from the human case.
But that's honestly, that is a rare perspective. And where did you get that perspective from? Is it been just the way you've been brought up? Is it hard earned through mistakes? Tell me a bit about that.
I don't know. I mean, should you just want me just a free form here?
Yeah, go for it. This is it. We're in.
Okay. So I don't know where it comes from, to be honest with you. I don't want to, well, you know, my mother, my sister. Yeah. I don't know, and so I'm not going to pretend to say I know where it comes from. I will tell you that what I can say is that I'm a student of people. Mm-hmm. I'm a student of human behavior. That's why I am in business. That's why I chose marketing. You know, even when I was kind of a teen, going from my teen into my 20s, you know, I've always been curious about people. Like, yeah. Insatiable curiosity about human behavior. Mm-hmm. Why do we do that? Why did you do that? Even if it was painful, there's always part of my mind that makes space for, wow, that was really terrible. I'm really upset. What the hell was that all about? There's always, you know, kind of my inquisitiveness is part of my makeup.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is then what flows from that is then, you know, why? And part of the kind of unending inquiry or persistent inquiry that I've got around human behaviors is also around how humans form meaning. Mm-hmm. So now I understand, after being in business for 30 years, why I went the marketing route. Part of that is because I'm fascinated with how humans create meaning. So in another career, like if I'm ever able to kind of get to my next career, be a professor, which I'd love to be a teacher or something like that, I'll probably go back and study semiotics and linguistics. Mm-hmm. Because I'm fascinated how humans, we're association machines, right? I mean, you studied that stuff a million times more than I have, but I know enough to be dangerous in the space around how we associate meaning to stuff.
Yeah.
And so that's maybe a little off track, but I do know that all actions are preceded by thoughts and feelings. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Therefore, the thoughts and the feelings that I have are as real, and in a lot of ways, more real than the actions that will flow from them. It mm-hmm. is not true that actions beget thought. Mm-hmm. Actions beget reaction, and thoughts that come from reaction, but all actions in this, like business, all decisions I will take, every action I will take during the day is preceded by thoughts and feelings. So it's if A equals B and B equals C, well then A equals C. It's illogical, mm-hmm. if not dangerous, if not reckless, mm-hmm. for me to not be mindful and aware mm-hmm. of those thoughts and feelings that are compelling my actions.
Yeah.
Talk about leadership presence. Mm-hmm. And usually that's talked about is not doing this. Uh-huh, yeah, okay, Jody, yeah, I think that's really fantastic, yeah, great. Or, oh, yeah, I feel you, Jody, that's great. Well, tell me about this. You know, that's typically what we talk about when we talk about leadership presence, like you're present for your people. I believe that you know, presence extends to this space as well. Is it to not be mindful and in touch with and respectful of the power of my thoughts and my feelings is almost like driving my car with my eyes closed.
Yeah.
Right? Like someone's going to drive itself. Mm-hmm. No. And you know, decisions proceed which way you turn the wheel. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. Not like the wheel, just start driving. No, you have to, you know. So again, I think this has been an area of thought for me. And I think 2020 has only poured gasoline all over this reality for me.
Yeah.
I like to say to my gang or to people that I have the opportunity to speak with is that crises, you know, they say never let a crisis go to waste.
Yeah.
And gifts can be found in crises, but you got to go looking for them. And I believe that one of the gifts of this pandemic and the circumstances around the pandemic, not the pandemic itself. I don't know that there's a lot of gifts of the pandemic, but the circumstances around the pandemic, like being locked up, staying home, feeling fear, not being able to go to a funeral, things like that, mm-hmm. has pierced the false veil between our human lives and our work lives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think that there's this kind of sheet that sits between our work, you know, our work lives and our live lives.
Yeah.
You know? And right now I'm in your room. You're in my room.
Yeah.
Right? And so we've all been confronted with the reality of the suffering, not only in our own lives, but the challenges of everybody that we work with.
Yeah.
And it's right there on display.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's right there on display. So what I found early, we got a little bit of an early jump on the coronavirus because I've got offices in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
And so when my team in Singapore had to go down and lock down, they were already being locked down by the government at the beginning of February. Mm-hmm. I gathered my leadership team together. I said, listen, I'm no expert on infectious diseases, but this looks like a fucking shit show, excuse my language. And so we prioritized family first.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like the thing here is when I share this with people and they ask, oh, is a company, is a business, is a CEO, have you worked? To not focus on family, you know, to not talk about, you got to take care of yourself. Mm-hmm. If you don't take care of yourself, you can't help others. And you got to take care of your loved ones, because if things aren't right with your loved ones in your home, forget about the ice cream. And then when you take care of yourself and your family, then you can come to work, and we're going to work to keep you safe and keep each other safe. And what you do out of work affects everybody you work with. You know, mm-hmm. that party you went to, now you're standing next to somebody at the ice cream machine dumping cookie dough chunks into our ice cream. So we all got to really, so the family, the interdependence was something we talked about from the very first moment. And I say that not as a look at me, look at how great we took care of our people. The business would die. And then to see businesses like Smithfield Foods or Tyson Foods, they killed their employees.
Mm-hmm. And how would you say they did that?
They, oh gosh, I mean, their malicious intent,
mm-hmm.
their callousness to prioritize processing chickens
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
for caring for their people.
Yeah.
They literally killed their employees. A business that kills its own employees and sickens people in the town.
Yeah.
Like all these thousands upon thousands of cases were all traced back to these meat processing plants. Yeah. Like, are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah.
So to say that, you know, your mental well-being, your mental fitness is not part of this, you're just kidding yourself.
Yeah.
You're just kidding yourself. To me, they're all connected like a chain of the strongest steel. It's not, I don't, anybody needs to be convinced they're a danger to their business.
Mm.
I know it sounds a little rough, but
yeah.
if you're not focused on this stuff, you should be removed by your board. And if your board's not demanding this, the board should be replaced. It's this fucking simple.
But it's true, like everything that you're saying, I know to be so true, because how do you separate the minds and the emotions from the decisions and how you show up in business versus who you are as a human? You can't, because we are ourselves all of the time, including our insecurities and our, you know, all of the different things that show up. But somehow, somewhere along the way, that has become the almost the accepted norm, that we don't talk about the inner stuff that's going on, or if we do, we only talk about it when it's already a bit too late, right? When people get the burnout or anxiety or depression, mm-hmm. etc. And so what I'd love to know, Matthew, is how is that showing up in Ben and Jerry's this year, or in general, you know, are mm-hmm. you having different conversations with your team? So clearly your mantra immediately of family first, that's a very clear message. And then beyond that, you know, is it just part of the fabric of your culture naturally, or have you had to do anything to let that live and breathe and give people permission to show up with mm-hmm. their thoughts and their emotions and all of the things?
Great questions. I'll tackle those in a few pieces. I think Ben & Jerry's has always had somewhat of a family mindset, and that has helped us. Even though we've been owned by Unilever for 20 years, there is still a sense of kind of family and familial connection. So that helps. That also has downsides too. As we know from any kind of family businesses that become big corporations, there's always ups and downs of kind of the family side of things, but for another conversation. In the most confusing moments, you know, in hindsight, it didn't plan this, but in February, in March and in April, when people literally didn't know how they became infected, they did not know how it was transmitted. Is it on my groceries? Is it in the air? What do I do? Can I even go outside? To provide that clarity to people about nothing is more important than our safety and our health. Mm-hmm. Nothing, not ice cream, forget about all that. And literally making it that clear to people was an action of, I think, humanity for my leadership team and I, and it was also about business preservation. Mm-hmm. It didn't have to be rocket science to know that if COVID comes into our plant and sickens our people, that's first and foremost a human catastrophe, mm-hmm. and it is a catastrophe for Ben & Jerry's ice cream.
Yeah.
To me, they weren't really actually separate. So how it showed up is clarity is power, and providing clarity to people, to each other, in particularly in moments of incredible stress and ambiguity, helped us get through those first few months. Is what I'd say. You know, how did it show up? That's how it showed up. I think another way that it showed up was. Talking explicitly always about vigilance.
Mm-hmm.
So you must be vigilant. And even if you're tired, even if you're feeling burned out, then you need to take a break. Why? Mm-hmm. Because we can't afford not to be vigilant. Mm-hmm. We're depending on each other. We cannot afford not to be vigilant. And so it wasn't a finger wagging thing. Mm-hmm. It was always a we thing.
So I
send out regular videos to the staff globally, and then I send out separate messages, sometimes video messages to folks in manufacturing. And it's not a finger wag type of vigilance. It's what I would say is I believe strongly that in 2020 has showed me this, is that compassion is a business imperative.
Mm-hmm.
Compassion is a business imperative. And I think that's the anchor to what we're talking about. And then the kind of partner thought that has emerged for me this year that I repeat constantly with my staff is vulnerability and vigilance. They actually go together and they're both needed. Whereas if you'd asked me 10 years ago or 20 years ago, I would say compassion is, you know, maybe a poster outside of the HR department or probably not even in our business.
Yeah.
Or the idea of vulnerability. I think I learned, you know, some really misguided notions growing up that, you know, vulnerability is bad.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Showing your, what's that? I'm sorry.
And typically we hear people say that it's a weakness, that if you show your quality.
Exactly. Going back to my very first point, is that vulnerability is weak. But in fact, the more vulnerability we're willing to share with each other, because it's there.
Yeah.
It's not like you are vulnerable. I don't like the idea. I don't agree with the statement, be vulnerable. I think we are vulnerable.
Mm.
And the courage is in revealing your vulnerability. Mm. Uh-huh. There's no courage in hiding it.
Mm-hmm. That's an important nuance, I think. It's the acknowledgement and the acceptance that we are already vulnerable. And
I'm afraid.
Yeah, yeah. And if you're not...
Afraid. And then the more I'm sorry?
No, I was just going to say, if you're not, like, afraid and have some anxiety, then you're probably not really in 2020.
you're just lying.
Yeah.
Just, I mean, it's so, like, again, if A equals B, B equals C, so I'm human, therefore, I'm vulnerable.
Yeah.
I'm afraid, I'm not sure. So the more I put those out there,
yeah.
Interestingly, the greater my capacity for vigilance is.
Uh-huh.
I can't really describe it, Jody. I'd never experienced it until this year in this way.
Yeah.
To me, they were related topics, tethered together, but not necessarily showing up at the same moment.
Yeah.
Now they arrive at the same moment.
Yeah.
The more I'm able to, and I'm not saying I'm great at it, I'm just saying the more I'm able to tell my staff, I'm afraid, I'm scared.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, but what I can tell you is duh.
Interesting.
The more vulnerability I'm willing to share, the stronger I feel in my vigilance to say, but I can tell you what absolutely cannot happen. But I tell you what absolutely must be true every single day. And interestingly, I think people have responded to that. I believe they've responded to that on the team, is that, wow, Matthew is really just revealing that he's freaking out. I'm fucking freaking out too.
Mm-hmm.
And he told us we have to do this. He's right. Let's do that. So, so interestingly, I didn't plan it that way, and maybe I'll be proven wrong, but I don't think so, is that the currency for people to power up their vigilance, to do what's necessary, actually is coming from our willingness to reveal our vulnerabilities to each other.
It's really interesting, and my hypothesis on that, and you know, obviously we do a lot of work in this space. My hypothesis on that, I've got a couple. One is, I think, when, first of all, it's self-awareness. Both are self-awareness, tuning into what's going on with me at the moment, acknowledging it, labeling it, and then having the courage to put voice to it, right? So first of all, it requires self-awareness. If you are being self-aware, I think that liberates vigilance. But more importantly, what it does, I think, and this is me, this is just hypothesizing on the spot, is if you're no longer using cognitive and emotional capacity to hide, because it takes energy to pretend, and that frees you up to use that capacity for vigilance. Mm-hmm.
Great.
And equally in leadership, we've been running sessions called Playing the Long Game, because what we've acknowledged is people are 8 months later, we're all still in crisis mode, and that is not sustainable. And in our leadership sessions where we speak about this topic, we're saying the worst thing that you could do right now is pretend that everything's okay, because everything is not okay. And while you pretend, you do not give the rest of the humans that you work with permission to respond to this in a normal human way. So the first thing you need to do is go, I didn't sleep last night. You don't need to show up freaking out. Just put voice to what's going on with you.
Love it.
That,
I love it.
Yeah, and immediately, there's a sigh in the room, relief, okay. And then, where we can't give certainty, because we can't, the mind actually doesn't work in absolutes. It's relative. So if you can give 5% more certainty than exists, that's actually enough for the human mind.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So what you just talked about, as in owning how you're feeling, but giving a little bit of more certainty. I don't know about all this, but what I do know is this. As a leader, that's exactly what's required of you. And it doesn't feel right, because it feels like, oh, I'm supposed to be the soldier and show that we know what we're doing. But vulnerability in this moment is exactly what's required. And it's very hard to do as well. So good work.
Cool.
Yeah.
Those are my thoughts.
Yeah, great. And what I'd like to ask you is, within Ben and Jerry's, is there something that you want to be doing more in this space? Do you have an idea of how do we live into this a bit more? Do you feel like you're already, you know, doing as much as you can in this space of the inner game and mental fitness and allowing permission to think and feel and show up as a full human?
Yeah, the short answer is we have a huge opportunity to do more, and there's probably two things as you're asking the question that I would share. One of them is the charter of our company is linked to prosperity. The idea that as our business grows, all the people we touch, they all benefit too. You know,
yeah.
The animals benefit, the earth benefits, everybody benefits from it. And our business, that's the vision, and it's supported by our three-part mission: the product mission, the economic mission, and the social mission. While I haven't spoken about our social mission, it is central to everything that we do. And what we've been able to do this year is to continue accelerating our work on climate justice and social justice. So in Europe, the worsening crisis about refugees and refugee and asylum seeker rights, we haven't backed off, we've stepped up. In the United States, you know, we've long fought for racial equity, but that's really been much more focused in the past few years. And so we took the program that we already had in place, and when the highly publicized, but not unique at all, murders of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and others erupted in the public awareness. They didn't just happen, but they erupted in the public awareness. We leaned into those things to kind of amplify our work. And that stuff is scary for some people. You know, we're talking about incredibly polarized places. The UK, which is our number two market, the US, our number one market. These are not places where people aren't polarized. The people are super, super polarized. And we get lots and lots of backlash. You know, politicians, we name Trump, we name Priti Patel in the UK, where people backlash against us. Fine. That takes a toll on people because, you know, it's scary. We don't know what's going to happen. And in a lot of ways, it's much more unpredictable than selling ice cream.
Yeah.
You know, I have a pretty good idea what Haagen-Dazs is going to do. And I've got a healthy respect for my enemies in the CPG world. And they've got good products, not as good as ours. They get smart people, not quite as sharp as ours, but they're super talented. In the social mission world, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know who's going to attack us. I don't know how the alt-right's going to show up, or neo-Nazis or fascists or whoever it me to come out and attack us. That is a huge area we're providing the team, and the team providing each other safety and security. When in fact, when we take a statement, our own employees go, some of them go, why'd you have to say that? Now I have to explain to my uncle so-and-so at the dinner table, like, why is Ben and Jerry's, you know, all this liberal bullshit? And why are you trying to divide us? And why are you trying to say things? And that's very, very difficult, particularly, I'd say, in the U.S., where awareness, there's a real new emergence of awareness by white people about structural racism and white supremacy culture. Most of us white people don't understand it. We're learning about it, and there's this incredible spasm. And that's part of the reason why Trump got elected. Let's just call it out. Fucking racism, okay? And whether people want to accept it or not, excuse my language, I hope there's no kids around.
I'm not at all. I'm Irish, you know that. It's punctuation for me.
So, that's an area where it's all emotion.
Yeah.
It is, you know, it dwarfs the CPG, the stuff I've been doing for my entire career, from an emotional lens.
Yeah.
It dwarfs selling ice cream.
Yeah. You know,
dwarfs selling deodorant, selling mayonnaise.
Yeah.
You know, it dwarfs that. And so I don't know, I don't have a good answer to your question, other than, oh yeah, we need a lot more, you know, trust, building trusting environments. And even in that room saying, I don't know, I don't have a crystal ball. Can you assure me? Like I had someone say to me the other day, that I won't go into details, but you know, a very senior person said, yeah, but can you assure me that our people are safe? I said, I can't assure you that people are safe before we run this campaign.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a ridiculous question you're asking. And I'm going to reframe it for people to go, oh, you're right. Like, come on.
Yeah.
Come on, cut my crap here.
Yeah.
You know, that's not real. So I don't know. I think that we are heading into I joke with my staff. I say, you know, the higher you go, the less you know. And that's becoming truer and truer every day. So at 52 years old, I have one foot and four toes of my other foot in yesterday.
Yeah.
No matter how hip and cool and knowledgeable I try to be, I was formed in yesterday.
And
therefore, to some degree, I am unfit for the future of leadership. But seriously, I'm a caretaker and I'm a bridge maker. And I don't think that senior people, we spent our whole lives, whether you've got 20, 30, 40 years of experience, you know, the hubris that comes with that is to be acknowledged.
Yeah.
The reality is that speed is an incredible democratizer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The speed of business and the speed of stuff means that I am less qualified.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean I'm not capable. It doesn't mean that I don't add value. It just means that I'm a danger to my people and I'm a danger to my brand if I don't recognize my weaknesses and my shortcomings as a leader.
Yeah.
And that takes, I think that takes some, you know, I'm not saying I'm good at it, but you know, wake up, people. It's nice to have a conversation about new power and let's give responsibility to younger people and let's get a bullshit. That is like 80s talk.
Mm-hmm.
We need a radical redistribution of power within organizations, or those organizations are dead. They just don't know it yet.
Mm-hmm.
And the momentum of our markets can carry a zombie a long time.
Really, really interesting. I think I respect your humility, because it's hard to come by in leadership, because we get trained to be more confident as we, and to have all of the answers.
Yep.
So this is counterintuitive. But your argument for it is absolutely sound. And what you'd said there about the future of your company and mental fitness and where you want to go next, you made such an important point about the social work that you're trying to do. And to do that work, you absolutely need people with good inner resolve, with self-awareness, with a grounding, with an understanding of who they are and a sense of purpose. Because otherwise, you know, you are taking risks and you are making a stand, and that's important. We need more people doing that in the world. But in order to do that, you do need resilient people, because that doesn't come easy. You know, there is always
a... No, and I also think that there's a lot of junior people that are like, oh, Unilever's stopping me. Oh, Unilever, the system, I can't make decisions, it's so bureaucratic, they this and they that. I'll stop them and say, who are you talking about? Well, you know, they. No, who? There is no they. And whoever they are, they're not going to be here in 3 years.
Yeah.
So who are you talking about? So interestingly, I find it's kind of the yin and the yang, is that the senior folks, we need to radically rethink. You know, I'll put my hand up first, right?
Yeah.
What our relationship with power is, and I talk about power a lot. I mean, power is, you know, I'm regularly talking about power. It's not a weird thing. It's that's how humans in groups get shit done. Power is, it's a force, right?
Yeah.
And so to not talk about it or be weirded out by, I think that junior people also need to step up their game.
Mm-hmm.
People that joined Unilever because it was the best company in the world, or the best CPG, or they're still in, a lot of people, young people, are in inculcation mode. I joined here to be taught. I joined here to be formed. I'm sorry. I had it easy when I was at your point. I could just be, put my nose to the grindstone, work hard, and have somebody maybe once a month or once a year go, yo, that Matthew McCarthy guy, he's pretty sharp. That was the old day. Now you walk in, you may know nothing, but I guarantee you're the expert on something. Maybe you're the only one on the team that actually uses TikTok.
Mm-hmm.
Then you lead all of us. You lead all of us on that. And so there's this kind of form, you know, kind of a shifting of power roles that has to happen. For another conversation, because we're running out of time, I am convinced that this world is already being run by people who are 15 to 20. They just don't know it yet. And the rest of us don't know it yet.
Mm.
I think the way an iceberg flips over when the top gets too heavy,
yeah,
it goes like this. I think this turning has already happened. And we see all kinds of signs of it, like the Parkland shooting in Florida and the way that high school students have rallied against that. The climate, racial equity. So even in the United States, the United States will become a minority-majority country in 2045. That has already happened for people under 18. People under 18 understand it's the most diverse generation in the history of, I think, the world,
mm-hmm,
certainly within the United States, which I know is still a very young country.
Yeah.
But it's gonna hit very hard and very fast. And I think the rise of populism and the resurgence of hate is a last gasp of old power structures that will be smashed apart by young people who say, all right, you're fucking done, old man. You're done.
I hope you're right. I really hope
I believe it. I believe it. Well, while we're obsessed about racial equity, I think it's as much about a youth thing where young people are going to be. And so I think there's a whole nother conversation. Yeah. But I actually believe, Jody, that people who are older, if you're 40, if you're 50, if you're 60, my job is to conspire with the 20-year-olds.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I can mentor them. Yes, I can be Mr. CEO. I can be all those things. But I must also be a co-conspirator and go into that kind of like hidden room with them and say, so what do you think we should be doing? And what do you need me to do? And they're like, oh my God, the CEO's asked me what we need to do. Yeah, but forget about all that power structure bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but the humans, we can't help but relate to power hierarchies.
I know.
So I'm trying to figure out. I walk into a room, Jody, and I look like this. And if I've got like a trucker cap on, people are like, is this guy a vagrant or is he serving? And then he goes, oh, Matthew, this is Matthew McCready, he's the CEO. It's the most bizarre thing. All of a sudden, everything changed because they found out I'm the CEO.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just this topic of power. Again, going back to it earlier, like why I'm so fascinated by how humans respond to, again, how they form meaning and the semiotic around titles like CEO.
And what it stands for and what it means.
I linked this conversation about redistributing power to the 20-year-olds, the 25-year-olds, not because they're young, but because they're the future.
Mm-hmm.
I am not the future.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm not the future.
Mm-hmm.
They are the future of Ben and Jerry's. And so I have to figure out, that's kind of one of my pet projects.
I have this image of you in a cellar now with a load of 20-year-olds plotting the future, which I absolutely love. I know we're out of time. I'd love to close with this one question. You can give me a 30-second answer or whatever you like. For the companies, the businesses, the leaders of brands, whatever, out there who are not taking mental fitness and the inner game seriously, who are ignoring it, what would you say to them to wake them up to the importance of it? And that's how we'll close.
I would say is... you are putting your business at peril and you don't even know it. You know, I would say that knowing that all the best stuff you've ever accomplished in your company, all the most proud worthy moments that you have, the things for which you have the biggest awards, the biggest monuments, the biggest memories for the greatest stuff you've ever done in your business or company was all preceded by thoughts and feelings, and codifying those preceding thoughts and feelings is your job in the forensics of creating tomorrow's excellence. And so to ignore it,
excellent. That was a money shot.
You do so at your peril.
That's so quotable.
And as a follow-up, mm-hmm. I'm also welcome your thoughts kind of in response to the stuff we've talked about. I don't need you to send me what you think about what I had to say. That's not the point.
Yeah.
But if anything we talked about stimulates, because you're thinking about this all the time, I'm thinking about it in different ways from a very different place.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm always want to keep the invitation open for people who are, not everybody's thinking about this shit, Jody.
I know.
So focused on this other stuff, but I can't sell more ice cream unless I do this. I can't grow the social mission unless I do this. It's like so clear. And I'm not saying I'm good at it. All I know is that. So when I meet business leaders that are literally talking about other stuff, I'll just sit there and be like, when is this fucking person going to actually start talking about the stuff that actually
matters,
is part of the forensics of awesome? I use that term a lot, forensics. You know, we talk about forensics usually in terms of things that bad happen, fight someone die, or why the car accident happened.
Yeah.
But it's more important, just as important, to think about the forensics of success.
I love that.
That's one of my most important concepts that I share with people is that usually when something goes wrong, we obsess about it and there's shame, and we all know that shame is the or one of the most powerful human emotions. On the flip side, when we have successes, we just all get drunk, or we, you know, yay, we collect an award, we pat ourselves on the back, and all the energy seems to go into either partying or ego.
Yeah.
When the reality is we need to be just as diligent about the forensics of. Why? Because at every moment of the day, we are upstream from tomorrow's failures and successes. And so I'm a student of the forensics of, now, how did this happen? Now, this is super awesome. I mean, we are celebrating. Think about how high we feel right now. This is amazing. are we all really sure about how this happened? Is there, what was the key thing, you know? And I know what I'm saying sounds really basic, right? Because, you know, post-launch evaluators and all the things we do, but the forensics of how we did the best stuff we did will invariably relate to thought and feeling.
Yeah, but the PLEs, they don't always happen. They only happen when something goes wrong. That's the problem. And I actually think that you would get on really well with Sean Conway, from the CEO of Peet's, because he was talking about, I don't care about the absence of negatives. I care about the presence of positives and how to have more of them. And you're talking about backwards engineering that. Let's learn how we did it and let's repeat it and do it again. You've got a lot of similarities there.
And trust will always be part of those, right? We all heard the adage that, you know, business can only move at the speed of trust. Organizations can only move at the speed of trust. But humans trusting each other, it's very front of the conversation, is that great things require lots of people. So moving mountains requires many shovels. People will not follow you unless they trust you.
100%.
So this idea of that trust is not just a trust to me is and it's for another conversation, but it's directly linked to how people feel. Right, because trust is something you feel. Trust is something you say. I analyzed it. We looked at the P&L 20 ways, and guess what? 30% more trust. No, that's not it. But humans, you know, we have to come together to do awesome stuff. And we will only accept or give help if we trust each other. What is trust? It's a feeling. It's a thought. So interestingly, one of the most important currencies of organizational theory, of organizational behavior, of results through people doing shit together, is trust. Which is purely a thought and a feeling.
I know. And a lot of the work that we do, we get briefs from leaders. We've got to work with the leadership team. There's a lack of trust. I think we need to get clear on roles and responsibilities. We need to refresh the strategy, yada, yada, yada. And I'm like, no, you don't. We need to accelerate your relationships. You need to know each other properly, like in a human way. You need to understand each other's values, learn about your past, like properly get to know each other. In the old days, you used to just get drunk with each other and you'd tell each other secrets and you'd connect. Today, that's a lot more difficult, but we spend a lot of time actually working with teams on understanding yourself, your beliefs, your values, and at the same time understanding that of the people that you work with, because that's when you can actually show up and truly say what you want to say and be in conflict when you need to be, but for it not to be seen as a big bad thing. Let's just get real here and be honest. But you can't. Well, we see a lot of teams have a politeness problem.
Because
there's no trust. When there's trust, just like families fight, you know.
Only tease the ones you love.
Exactly. Thank you, Matthew. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Hidden Edge. Remember to subscribe and review and visit symbiotepartners.com for the latest on mental fitness for leaders and their teams.